That happy music means that you are at Pop Culture Happy Hour, where the discussions of pop culture are real, but the cocktails are entirely in our heads. I am Linda Holmes, the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See, and I am here with your usual cast of Happy Hour partiers. Trey Graham, why don't you tell me who you are?
I am your colleague on the NPR Arts Desk and the man sort of responsible for the movies presence at NPR.org.
And Glenn Weldon, who are you?
Well, I write about comics for Monkey See, and I also review books for the NPR website.
How about you, Stephen Thompson? Who in the heck are you?
Well, I am occasionally patiently tolerated at NPR's Monkey See, but I'm also an editor at NPR Music.
And of course, all my dear pals.
Oh, who loves you, Holmesy?
Shaw.
All right, so what we're going to talk about first this week, we have all seen Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Some of us more than once.
Some of us more than
who
once.
Who would that be?
I bet I know. To begin with, I think it's fair to say Scott Pilgrim versus the World did not make a tremendous amount of money in its first weekend. It was not uniformly embraced by the public.
I was going to say it was us and six or eight of our friends.
That's right.
No.
Us and a handful of other people. So sad. So the movie made $10.5 roughly $1 million.
Correct.
In the first weekend. Interestingly enough, I looked and it's less than Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist.
$500,000.
Look at Glenn Weldon bringing the data.
I'm ready.
And about half, a little more than half as much as Kick-Ass, which was the previous disappointing comic book movie.
All right.
It also made far less than half of Eat, Pray, Love, and far less than a third of The Expendables.
Yeah, but let's take a look at what really happened this weekend. So It was beaten by The Expendables, it was beaten by Eat, Pray, Love, which just means that jocks and narcissistic rich girls beat geeks. Why is anybody shocked by this?
None of this is new. You've seen Mean Girls, right?
Exactly. This is the way it's supposed to be. This is comforting. As it was in Study Hall, so it is on the weekend box office. I don't think this should shock anyone.
I'd also like to point out that this movie made more on its opening weekend than did Shaun of the Dead or Hot Fuzz, the two previous movies from this director, Edgar Wright.
It cost six times as much money.
And it also opened in about five times as many theaters as Shaun of the Dead did and about two and a half times as many theaters.
Fair point. But you can't call this a comic book movie the way you would call Batman or Spider-Man or Superman a comic book movie, because those aren't really comic book characters anymore. They're intellectual property, right? They're much bigger than the comic books that birthed them.
Franchises.
Exactly. Scott Pilgrim is six graphic novels from a small independent publisher, and that name was not known by anybody outside the people who read and loved the books before this movie came out. So, I mean, we have to compare. If you're going to compare it, you insist on calling it a comic book movie.
I don't insist on comic. I believe it's based on comic books.
But it's okay. So put it in like History of Violence. Put it together with Road to Perdition, or especially Ghost World. Compare this to Ghost World, not to Batman.
Right, and I think that part of the media coverage of the box office of it is somewhat focused on the fact this was a very big budget movie for how it performed. And now, to the extent that any of us ultimately are charged with the task of caring how it did at the box office, we've all seen the movie. What did we think of the movie?
I loved the movie.
Yeah.
I thought the movie was very, very good.
I found it rather enjoyable.
Yes. Famously.
Yeah.
I dug it. I thought it was a smart, funny, quirky little movie that wears its sort of cult wannabe status on its sleeve. So it is really destined to become one of these movies that people quote a lot and is referred to often. In that sense, it felt very much to me like a quirk fest, like Nick and Nora's Ultimate Playlist, like 500 Days of Summer, like Juno, which made $10 million its opening weekend, by the way.
Oh, look at that. Dun, dun, dun.
So, I mean, it's quirky and very entertaining, and I dug it.
I liked the film. I felt, oddly enough, somewhat the same way about it that I felt about Inception, which is that it was this visually dazzling movie that was trying to do incredibly and successfully doing some incredibly inventive things.
Well, tell folks what it's about a little bit.
It's about Scott Pilgrim, the young man who has to battle the seven evil exes.
If we're going to date, you may have to defeat my seven evil exes.
You have seven evil ex-boyfriends?
Seven evil exes, yes.
And I have to fight?
Defeat.
Defeat your seven evil exes if we're going to continue to date?
Pretty much.
So what you're saying right now is we are dating?
I guess.
Does that mean we can make out?
Sure.
Cool.
And the battles take the form of sort of video game fight sequences.
Very much
complete with all sorts of visual tricks and quirks.
Given the comparison to Inception, I felt less out of my depth at Scott Pilgrim than I did three-quarters of the way through
Inception.
But not that I couldn't follow Inception, but I just sort of stopped caring about it three-quarters of the way through.
Well, I will say that my harshest criticism of both movies is that they're somewhat emotionally hollow at their core. Mm-hmm. I did not care a whit who he wound up with, if anybody. The relationship meant absolutely nothing. I mean, it was part of almost the joke of the movies that they had absolutely nothing going for them as a couple. I also...
Well, except that neat sort of hyperspace portal travel thing she does.
I don't think lots of relationships
when they just start out or have that going for them. I feel like I'm sort of holding the water for the harshest critics of this movie. And I enjoyed it. I liked this movie. But it felt a little bit, and I think this might be one reason it didn't do terribly well, it felt a little bit like peeking in on someone's inside joke. The people I've talked to who didn't want to see the movie sort of felt like there was kind of this undercurrent of, that movie's not for me.
Mm-hmm. Right, but you, but this movie, to the degree that it's for people who have a, you know, an interest in video games or background in video games or some understanding of that entire world, it's not current video games. It's not first person shooters. You've played Super Mario.
Right.
Well, I know you have. I know for a fact
you have.
I'm just going to say right now. And so when he has the little extra life and he's grabbing the little one up, it's not like that's a current, crazy, you know, obscure, arcane video game reference. That's a really basic video game, arcade game reference. And you own arcade games.
I have 6 full-size stand-up arcade machines
so,
from the 80s.
So but how that's can not you the... be saying it's peeking in on someone else's inside joke? It's peeking in on your inside joke.
Right, but that's still, I think that's still somewhat of an issue. I mean, if somewhat that movie's made for people, I feel like that movie was made for people my age. Mm-hmm. When I hear people say, oh, that's made for 22-year-olds, it's
right.
not. It's people
no,
who
completely
were
wrong.
People who were 22-year-olds when I was 22. There is a huge undercurrent of sort of mid-90s pop culture.
So it's made for you.
Right, and that's a problem.
Because most of America is decidedly not like
it. Right. Most of America has rejected me.
Yes, I can't very well say you feel alienated by the movie because it's made for it's made for people too much like me.
On behalf of others. That's very noble.
I want to say, though, that I am not at all that guy. I am the kid who went to the arcade 4 or 5 times during his teens, and I've played Dance Dance Revolution a couple of times with my nephews, and I had a blast. I really enjoyed it. There may be people who fear being alienated by this movie, but I am those people, and I really enjoyed it.
It's a fair point, especially about the lack of emotional ballast here, because, I mean, it's an experiment in condensation. The books, I'm not going to keep talking about this, about the books, but the books have a lot more emotional weight because they have a lot more room to kind of explore. You really get to know the character a little bit more. And as I mentioned in one of the blog posts, in the book, he is a cipher. He is just willful and thoughtless and clueless. And what Sarah's performance does, and again, this is one of those...
Michael Cera, the star of the movie.
What Michael Cera's performance does is divide people into people who love Michael Cera and hate Michael Cera, and that's pretty much your reaction to this film is going to be a lot of it. If you are not picking up what Michael Cera is laying down, this is not the movie for you.
Why does everything have to be so complicated?
If you want something bad, you have to fight for it. Step up your game, Scott. Break out the L word.
Lesbian?
The other L word.
Lesbians?
It's love, Scott. I wasn't trying to trick you.
Because he plays it so frail and wussy, he's giving him a little bit more emotional ballast. He's filling in the work that the really happy, bright, cartoony art does in the books by being somebody who is so wussy that when he does kick butt, you can kind of feel a sort of cathartic something going on.
So perhaps Stephen cannot relate because the guy is too wussy.
Yes, I'm sure that's what it is. He cannot possibly relate to what it was like to be a skinny, scrawny 22-year-old. That is totally alien to me, you're right.
With a tendency toward geekery.
With a tendency toward geekery.
Who likes music a whole bunch.
Right. Yeah.
Now I understand.
Foreign.
Now I understand. We were going to actually also talk about one other thing tangentially about Scott Pilgrim, which is that all of us had the experience of seeing the trailer prior to Scott Pilgrim. Now, let me set the scene here. I went to see Scott Pilgrim with Glenn, who had already seen it once. And the trailer started, and Glenn said, I'll tell you what's going to happen when the name of the director comes up in this trailer. You're going to hear snickering. And I had heard this reported over the summer in a couple of places, so I possibly should have seen it coming, but you really sort of don't believe it until you see it for yourself. And I would say it was not snickering. It was an outright guffaw.
Mm-hmm.
And when you see the trailer, it's for a movie called Devil, taking place in an elevator.
You hold that?
Sorry.
Satan is in an elevator, right. Which if you've ever been in an elevator on a hot day and you've been sweaty, you do understand how you come up with the idea of Satan being in an elevator.
Absolutely.
Uh-huh. This is not good.
Why is elevator 6 in inspection mode?
Oh, come on, man.
What's happening?
Nothing, just relax. What was that?
Oh, my God.
You all right?
You're bleeding.
Oh, my God.
It feels like something bit me.
What was that?
However, when the director's name comes up, it is M. Night Shyamalan.
First of all, when I saw Scott Pilgrim, it was Saturday night. Theater was about half full. Exact same reaction.
Mm-hmm.
I'm watching the trailer. I had remembered hearing you talk about this phenomenon of people snickering when M. Night Shyamalan's name came up. I had forgotten that by the time I was watching this trailer, at which point people are in an elevator, some sort of unseen sinister force is blah, 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 blah. M. Night Shyamalan, half derisive groaning, mm-hmm. half derisive laughing simultaneously, followed by the guy next to me shouting out the twist of a lesser-known M. Night Shyamalan movie to explain away why people in the elevator are behaving as they do. As failed sort of marketing strategies go, it should be noted, Mike Katziff, our esteemed producer, director, spirit guide. We were talking about this earlier, and I looked on IMDb. M. Night Shyamalan did not direct this movie.
Oh, it's just there as the producer credit.
He wrote the story. Which clearly means, first of all, whatever dumbass twist it is his idea,
right.
And that's all it is. So he had nothing to do with the movie, except he came up with whatever stupid twist is going to have everybody, you know, ugh.
It didn't seem to come to full flower until The Last Airbender.
Right.
But even prior to that, he would put these little things in the movie where when he misses by a lot. Mm-hmm. When he misses in these sort of comically large, super weirdly serious kinds of ways. And in a way, I'd like to admire the ambition, but this is how you become the guy.
You're right. He swings big and he misses big. He's like Babe Ruth pointing at the stands, saying, I'm going to hit it to the 95-year-old grandmother who's here with her three generations
exactly.
of grandkids. And then he loses his grip on the bat and it hits her in that head.
I totally thought that was going in a different direction.
Yeah.
I thought he tied his shoelaces together.
I just want to pause
Ran
and
the sports again.
Really just admire that. Right
Trey
there.
Graham, bring in the sports.
Trey Graham,
your
bring
sports
in the sports. Glenn, would you like to repeat that golf is not a sport?
No, it's okay. The thing that comes up, it'll come up.
Is that a tradition now? Sure. Or?
But it is an interesting question. The Last Airbender is sort of your theory, but looking on IMDb for the films that M. Night Shyamalan has made, he did Wide Awake with Rosie O'Donnell. I'm not sure the public had made up its mind about it yet.
Wow.
He did The Sixth Sense, which people pretty universally loved.
Heard of that.
People forget that he did Unbreakable
mm-hmm.
with Samuel L. Jackson.
Oh, I remember
which was either excellent or wackadoo, depending on your perspective.
It was pretty dumb. But go ahead.
It was pretty dumb? Okay,
I
know.
It was dumb and wackadoo, yeah.
Okay. There are people who like that movie, though, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think those people were still riding the wave of The Sixth Sense,
yeah.
to be honest. I think those people were still thinking, whatever he does, it's like way deeper than you can tell at first.
Yeah. I can't wrap my head around it yet,
exactly.
but I'm sure that when I do.
Exactly. I think they were expecting some kind of. So they thought of it as twistier than it was. It's not actually that twisty. Right. Like, it sort of is, but not really.
Okay, then Signs.
Yeah.
Mm. Cornfield.
No. Is it The Village?
The Village, after
yes.
That,
there's the sort of Amish people in the. You know.
Okay, so The Village, universally regarded as idiotic.
Obviously, there are always dissenters, but I think, for the most part, received very poorly.
Now, what I'm wondering is if the collective thought bubble over the movie-going population hit to hell with that guy when, was it Lady in the Water?
Lady in the Water was
I think it was around Lady in the Water, at least I would start to say it became very divided. Some people were still fans. Other people were very suspicious of anything he did.
The Happening?
Once that came out, I think he was on the slide. down. Because, again, he built up this expectation that everything was going to have these giant twist
giant
endings.
Jolting twist.
First of all, what the villain is, which is the closest thing to a twist, happens very early.
Mm. Right.
So there isn't a twist that comes at the end. Sorry if you were planning on seeing that happening. There's no giant twist at the end. So, you know, by then people were having to sort of adjust their expectations.
By then, people were giggling at the trailer where you see Mark Wahlberg staring at a bush. You know, just sort of frowning at it while it blows in the wind.
True.
I mean, people were already onto him.
That is true.
But at that point, were they openly jeering at the trailers for his movies?
I don't think they were openly jeering at the mention specifically of his name. I think, like Glenn said, they were starting to jeer at some of the goofy imagery.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you know what it's like? Do you remember the movie August Rush?
No.
Why
okay.
no? In fact,
the movie August Rush has Carrie Russell. And somebody, who's a really, really good-looking guy, and I can't remember who it is. Anyway, they play a couple, and they have a kid, and the kid grows up and has to look for them because they give him up for adoption, I believe. Mm-hmm. And the kid becomes sort of this running around in the world, meeting colorful people looking for his parents. Okay. And you watch the trailer, and it kind of looks like sensitive movie about... he's like a musician. He's like a prodigy.
Oh, the song was nominated for an Oscar.
Yes, exactly. That. And then there's this moment where the kid is in the park, and he's meeting various colorful characters, and one of the colorful characters is Robin Williams.
Oh.
What? So you just see what just happened?
And this happens in the trailer.
See what just happened?
Abort, abort, abort.
See what just happened? When I saw that trailer in theaters, you could sort of see people going along with this trailer. Because at this time, this was sort of high in the Carrie Russell cycle post-Felicity, pre-Waitress.
Sure.
She had a lot of goodwill going for her. It looked like a sweet movie. There's a lot of music. It looks upbeat and sort of inspiring and fun. And then all of a sudden, you're looking at not only Robin Williams, but Robin Williams in his full-on manic, I'm a crazy guy you meet in the park.
Fisher King.
And as soon as this
Robin
happens,
Williams and Fisher King. Mm-hmm.
You could just feel the audience just go, whoop. And all the doors just slammed shut in everybody's mind. And that's what I saw with the trailer for The Devil. And that, I don't think he was there at the time of the happening. I think there were individual things he would put mm-hmm. in trailers that would make people say, oh, that guy's up to his old tricks again. But it wasn't like you would watch along the trailer. They would identify him, and specifically the identification of him would make people go, oh, then definitely not.
Dollars to Donuts, the next time we see a trailer for this film, it's not going to include his name. Because he didn't, you're right, he didn't direct it. So, wow. Because that's what I thought. That's the only thing I took away.
Yeah. From M. Night Shyamalan directed this movie, right. Even though he...
Well, and I just thought, when I was watching it, I just thought, if I were the marketing team for this movie, this would just send an ice cold shiver down my spine that in the middle of your suspenseful, for what's clearly supposed to be a very suspenseful movie. And creepy. It's supposed to set this very, very creepy and unsettling tone.
Yeah, it looks like a horror thriller.
Of a sudden, people are just laughing.
Yeah.
And it completely blows the entire tone of the trailer that they have set up until that point.
See, and I was trying to think after I'd seen it. I mean, Robin Williams is a really good example. Who else has reached the point of being that kind of poison? And also getting back a little bit to the discussion of Michael Cera.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who speculate that people hate Michael Cera because of Year One, because he's played sort of the same role. Now, all of a sudden, the audience has turned on Michael Cera. And
I certainly think people who write about movies are beginning to turn on Michael Cera, which is kind of not fair. As it happens, I just watched Youth in Revolt the other night. And, you know, he's playing not just that character, but a very different character in that movie at the same time. And both of those two characters are somewhat different from Nick and Nick and Nora.
Or George Michael Bluth.
Or George Michael Bluth and the hero in Scott Pilgrim. And, you know, it's a limited range, I'll grant you, of things that he's doing, but his choices are specific. And he's a thoughtful actor, I think, and it's kind of unfortunate that he's getting this kind of rap.
That's an interesting question, though, whether he's in that same position now where people see that and it becomes a negative. Like, I don't want to see another movie with that guy.
And one thing that I was wondering is why him and not, if it's because of Year One, has the public also turned on Jack Black?
Yes.
Who you could argue...
I think very possibly,
you could argue
yes.
that Jack Black does the same shtick.
I think if you saw a trailer right now with Jack Black, it's very possible that you would see maybe not as extreme a reaction, but certainly a lot of people who would suddenly be like, oh, no, never mind, I'm out.
So who's next?
Well, you got in the background, you got Jesse Eisenberg as the thinking man's Michael Cera, who's sort of waiting in the wings. I don't think you have anybody like that for Jack Black. I think
I'm gonna nominate Zach Galifianakis for
real. Oh, that's a good point. That's an excellent point. Yeah,
for the next,
if Galifianakis does a string of just obnoxious, annoying movies, I could see the audience turning on that guy.
Oh
really
yeah,
quick.
I mean,
is Zach Galifianakis the new Robin Williams?
Well, certainly not yet. Certainly not yet. But I think if you're looking for,
is he tomorrow's Robin Williams?
It's a good question. We'll just have to wait and see. All right. The next thing we wanted to do this week, in lieu of the Regrettable Television Pop Quiz.
It'll come back. Don't worry.
It will be back, but there's only so much Regrettable Television. You don't want to consume all of it before we've had a chance to think it all the way through.
No, we were putting an enormous amount of thought into this podcast.
We're going to talk about something called Pop Culture Blind Spots, and this was an inspiration of Glenn's. And so I'm going to let Glenn start. And what we were going to do is talk a little bit about something in popular culture that you simply do not engage with and do not care to, and despite the fact that perhaps other people encourage you to do so. Glenn, take it away.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think the important thing here, if you're playing along at home, is that this thing has to be...
people with notepads.
Exactly. If you're scoring at home, this thing has to be something that you are at least notionally open to. This is not about being superior and Mr. Sparty Pants and saying, I reject this.
This isn't something I hate.
This also isn't, I reject Tila Tequila.
Exactly.
Right. It's I reject something that people think is good.
Right.
Something which we do not get, but to which we are at least notionally open, or SWDNGBTWWAALN. No, for short.
Glenn.
So, my pop culture blind spot is Friday Night Lights. And this discussion will entail me having to work you all through some of my psychopathology. So hold on.
Hold on, I'm going to go grab a soda.
Please do. I'm open to this. I like the cast. Smart, funny people have told me that this is a show that is good. I trust these people, but I do not trust them completely, because when they come to me and they say, Friday Night Lights, you have to see it. Oh, my God, you're not watching it. I say, yeah, not a big football guy. And they say, to a man, to a woman, they say, it's not about football. And I believe that they are lying to me, because this show is about football. So we have to take a step back. My family.
The psychological wounds.
Here we go. Oh, here my we go. God. All right.
My mother. No.
Cut to a crib.
Well, not quite. My parents, huge football fans. Huge Eagles fans, to be specific. When I was 4, I referred to Sundays as Shouty Day, because it was the day when my parents would scream at the television, which would send me up to my room to play with my superhero action figures.
Steven, I think that's what your kids call Sunday, too.
That's right. Yeah, my kids call Sunday.
My mom has 3 topics of conversation. They are high school, they are sports, and high school sports. So there's that stew of emotional drama.
So let me ask you a quick question, Glenn. I don't want to cut you off. But
please.
If I admit that it's about football, does it help if I tell you it's not about your mom?
Well, here's the other thing. I'm going to make a sweeping generalization here, that writing about sports, and fiction and nonfiction, is, I posit, I assay, the worst writing in the world. And here's why. Here's why. Follow me here.
Dude, I'm going to take your lunch money before this.
I put it in my wallet just for that purpose. So, based on this, my vision of what this show is...
Wrong.
Hold on. Part Brian Song, right? Part Hoosiers, part Miracle, and part Dawson's Creek schmoopy teenagers having angst.
No.
Okay? Have at it.
Okay.
I'm going to let you finish, but I have to say that I am so with Glenn on this one. The reason I understand everything people say about the greatness that is Friday Night Lights, but I too have not watched it. And it's because I grew up in South Carolina and my cousin was a cheerleader.
There we go.
Some of my other cousins were football players.
Well, people are wounding us.
Are you under the impression that I was a cheerleader?
For the same reason, it was your delivery, Linda Holmes, and nothing else. It was for the same reason that I cannot bring myself to go see The Blind Side, which is Southern Lady inspiring football goodness.
This is what I think.
I can't do it.
Okay. Friday Night Lights is a show about one of the few functional marriages on television. Mm-hmm. Is part of it. That would be A. It is a show about a school, much more than it is a show about football. The main function...
Headers school or Breakfast Club school?
Neither. School.
All right.
School. Where did you go to school?
It's a tone
I didn't go
question.
To either Heather's school or Breakfast Club school.
Mine was
the Quaker school.
I went to.
Anyway, so it's much more about education than it is about football. The stories about the coach are much more about his position as a teacher than they are in his position as a coach. There are certainly football games. There are certainly football games that are taken seriously by the people in the show. But for the most part, what the coach is trying to do most of the time is raise great kids who, in some cases, don't have a lot going for them.
Every man at some point in his life is going to lose a battle. He's going to fight and he's going to lose. But what makes him a man is that in the midst of that battle, he does not lose himself. This game is not over. This battle is not over. So let's hear it one more time. Together. Clear eyes, full hearts.
Let's go! It's about football in the sense that football creates the plot elements.
Okay, that's what I was asking.
But it's about football in the same way that Scott Pilgrim is about fighting.
Right. Okay. So, but the engine...
My mind was just...
Or if you like, it's about football the same way Aquaman's about water.
Okay. now we're just being hurtful. Now we're just throwing it out there. Omnidirectionally, Linda Holmes. But the engine of the plot is not every season they have to win the big, I want to say, match. Am I wrong?
The spine of the season of the show involves the football season, which sometimes goes one way and sometimes goes another way. Okay. I will promise you they have not won the championship every season. Okay? So it's not always geared around giant victory.
If you assure me that there is no cheap sentimentality here, I'm in.
There is no cheap sentimentality.
I'm in.
There is sentimentality. There is feeling.
Sentiment, not sentimentality.
There is sentiment. There is stirring of the heart. You know, but not in a bad way. I would say there's stirring of the heart in many, many, many things that are very good.
Are there many slow motion drives down the field accompanied by swelling music?
Excellent question.
There are certainly occasional, you know, big plays. There are occasional big football plays. But, you know, without exception, the reason why you are expected to care about the big football play is what's going on with the kid.
Okay.
You are not necessarily expected to invest individually in the idea of winning, except that winning means a lot to the individual kid. And usually whatever is happening on the field is related very closely to whatever is going on with the people on the show. And that's the sense in which it's not about football. But it is about football. I'm not going to stand here and say you're not going to watch a lot of stuff about people playing football, because then I'd be a big liar.
Isn't there also just an extraordinary amount of eye candy on this show?
Well, yeah.
No, that actually helps.
No, there is.
I'm doing my best. I actually haven't seen it. There are many good-looking people.
Steven in particular, I'm very confident, would like it a great deal. It's a show that I never promise people that they will like because the pilot did not work on me at all. I did not respond to the pilot myself. It wasn't until the show had sort of established itself a little bit and everyone I knew started telling me how great it was. And I did go back and give it a chance. And at that point, I was able to watch a bunch of it at the same time, which also might be helpful.
Right. I have piled a lot of emotional baggage on this table, and you have finally scaled it.
I'm
going to give it a shot.
I've tried. Think of me as your football Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Good then.
Linda Holmes.
Always relating to me.
Nice. Before we stray too far from the topic of pilots that don't grab you right away.
Yes.
Can I mention that my pop culture blind spot is Modern Family?
Heresy.
You can.
I know. Because I actually am sort
You'll
of...
be wrong.
Now, what does this have to do with your past?
That's right. Let's tie it all together.
Dysfunctional family.
Trey's like, yeah, that's what I
I've only watched the pilot. And I know that you, my other half, many people tell me that this show is worth watching. And I am certainly pleasantly disposed toward Jesse Tyler Ferguson and a couple of the other people in the cast. I found them all so thoroughly disagreeable in the pilot episode that I need to be convinced that I want to spend time with these characters more.
You know, they are disagreeable in the sense that they often do not seem happy on the surface, but they're not unkind to each other. And I am not a big fan of family shows where everybody's mean to each other all the time. Mm-hmm. That was one of the reasons I never really got into Everybody Loves Raymond. I always felt like there was actually too much actual hostility mm-hmm. between people on that show. Modern Family, you get a lot of the sort of gruff grumping at each other, but ultimately the people will show up for each other.
Yeah, that's in some ways what I found off-putting about the pilot, because it wedges all of that into that one introductory 30 minutes or 22 minutes.
Right.
It introduces how many? Six really quirky, idiosyncratic, largely disagreeable people. And then it brings them all together in a room where they all go, ooh, ah, new baby.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, they do. But they're also sort of chuckling at the silliness of the, you didn't laugh at the Lion King presentation of the baby?
Well, yeah, yes.
So you're going to get a lot of that.
Yeah, because the characters themselves are kind of tropes. I mean, it's our sitcom mm-hmm. tropes. We have the precocious kid in Manny. We have the goofy dad. We have the high-strung wife. We get the gay couple, which I think is a pretty good depiction of a gay couple, sort of a normal, in a sense that they're weird, but they're within this show's universe of weirdness.
Mm-hmm. You know, no, actually, maybe you should do this.
Why?
I don't want to bump her head against the door, you know, pinch her with the seatbelt.
Mitchell, how long are you going to beat yourself up over one mistake? Is this going to be like the Bond highlights all over again?
I think I suck at being a father.
What are you talking about? We're new at this.
Yeah, but you're such a natural. I mean, look at you.
We each have our own strengths. Now, who are amazing parents?
We are.
I can't hear you.
We are.
Don't you forget it.
Okay. Did we just lock our baby in the car?
Did you put the keys in the bag?
I put the keys in the bag.
That's oh, Mitchell, I told you not to put the keys
don't
in the
freak
bag.
Out. Come on, don't freak out.
Oh, Lily, it's okay.
ABC.
What are you singing to her? People get arrested for this, Mitchell. Breaking the window!
Emergency assistance, this is
Trina. We locked our baby in the car and people are judging us.
What seals the deal for me on the show is the writing. Jokes, individual jokes. There is one joke where this show went from being a good show to a great show, and I'll tell you what it is. The one of the members of the gay couple is talking to the Ed O'Neill character. The Ed O'Neill character says, oh yeah, you mean the old balls and chain? Now, that is a good joke. That is a solid joke. Why? Because it's so simple. You don't have to push ball and chain too hard to get to balls and chain. Just right. Add an S. Yep. There's an inevitability to that joke. That joke should have been made years ago. Mm. But it was made here, and it's one of many. It's tossed off. Mm. But that is when I started to love this show.
And again, I would distinguish, you know, Trey, I'm 90% confident would enjoy Modern Family. Steven, I'm 100% confident will enjoy Modern Family.
And like Friday Night Lights, that is on my list of shows I have not seen but will see. And maybe we should treat this like a homework assignment or something.
Absolutely.
Though I am not going to watch the show that I...
All right. Well, then we should just... We'll go directly to Steven. What is yours, Steven?
Mine, I don't think will take long because I've never seen more than a trailer for it and was so massively put off by it. My show is Breaking Bad.
My name is Walter Hartwell White. To all law enforcement entities, this is not an admission of guilt. I am speaking to my family now. There are going to be some things that you'll come to learn about me in the next few days. I just want you to know, no matter how it may look, I only had you in my heart.
My objection to the idea of Breaking Bad is that it looks like just one of these sort of just relentlessly brutish dudes shooting each other in graphic fashion, and that is sort of the God is dead, people are evil, have some drugs. And that's the entire show. And I do watch Big Brother. I would rather watch the 12th season of Big Brother then watch this, what is clearly like one of the most acclaimed and highly respected shows on television. And I would rather, I don't know, name your unpleasant act. I just have zero interest whatsoever in Breaking Bad.
So you are about meth the way that Glenn is
about football. Mm. Exactly. I would absolutely rather watch.
I have only seen Breaking Bad a very little bit. I have seen a couple of episodes of it, and the rest of it is sitting on my various... I have it saved.
Well, I can tell you that it is a topic, in part I can tell you this because I edit these pages for the web. It is a topic that Fresh Air returns to with some regularity. It is very popular in Philadelphia.
What I would say about it...
Eagles and meth.
What I would say about it, and you're right about it, in the sense that extremely brutal. And it's brutal in a very different way from shows like The Sopranos or something like that, where there's a lot of operatic shooting.
Right.
My sense of this show is that one of the things it gets at is the cartoonish ineptitude of most low-end criminals. In the sense that a lot of what you see is that when things are going wrong, they go sort of disastrously
haywire,
and there's a lot of running. It's disorganized. It's crime as this sort of, I mean, people are diabolical, but they're also not that smart, which is how crime is in real life.
This is actually also a lot like Big Brother.
Yes, exactly. Very good. Very good. So I mean, I'm not in a position to speak, you know, obviously very intelligently to Breaking Bad, but
it's a slightly more nihilistic Weeds then.
I think it's much darker than Weeds, which I also don't really watch. Like I said, I'm not really in a position to speak intelligently to the show very much, except that's my sense is that that's why it's so hard for me to watch too.
We might need to throw this open to the commenters then, I suppose.
Yes, absolutely.
Why should I watch Breaking Bad if somebody can convince me?
Well, they're going to tell you great acting and great writing. I mean, I know. But you have to sort of, you know, in terms of hooking into it, I have the same problem.
There is a sense with a lot of things, and I'm sure this speaks ill of me as a consumer of culture, but if there's just a sense that it's not going to be fun at all,
right. And it's just going to be bleak.
And it's just going to be nothing but just, the human is going to be
I'm kind of, I have trouble getting into some of that stuff, too. And there are certain things that tend to be at least somewhat dark, like Mad Men and things like that, and Lost was like this, too, that I can still enjoy because there's more of a mix. But it is true that Relentlessly Bleak is very hard for me to watch, too.
Well, I feel better about the fact that I am never going to watch it.
And and so my pop culture blind spot.
Here we go.
Is don't worry, it's not comic book characters.
I was gonna say, is it Aquaman? Because Glenn is just poised.
It's not comic book characters. It's hobbits.
Oh,
it's hobbits and Lord of the Rings and all things Tolkien. And I have tried, but only a little. Mostly, I don't like creatures. I don't like
I've decided to write off all creatures.
I don't like little creatures. I don't like things that live in the ground. I don't like quests. I don't like epics. And I don't like big hairy feet. And this has become something where I just, at this point, am I going to launch into it now? It's like it becomes one of those things where I've lived this long.
Yeah.
You know?
Did you try Hobbit try, or did you try Fellowship of the Ring try? Did you try with the books or with the movies?
No, I think is the question.
When you
the
said
answer.
You have tried, in what form did this trying, air quotes?
I think I tried more. I tried more, like, I thought about watching the movies.
There we go.
So you haven't actually picked up the books?
No.
No.
Oh.
Well.
They're such big books.
No, but I mean, the movies, you should just sit down when you've got like 11 hours.
Just
sit down and watch the
movies.
They're
such big books. It's like, what am I doing?
Listen, if you ever want to set aside like 11 hours to watch the movies, I have the trilogy in its shrink wrap.
Okay.
Because I, too, have never seen any of the movies.
Life is so short, and the books are so long.
You have the cultural literacy to be able to talk about
I thought he was
going to
say, like, of a snail.
No.
Right, you can talk about Twilight.
If you can talk about Twilight, you should be able to talk about Tolkien. Now, not a well-versed sort of, you know, I can quote the Silmarillion, not that kind of Tolkien, because that is my job. But
Glenn, I can tell you from experience, can actually do the whole taxonomy of the elves.
I really can. So, these books grab you or they totally do not. And I understand if you reject an entire genre of quest and fantasy, well then, this ain't going to be your thing.
It's people with punctuation in their names, right?
Well, there's a lot of...
One of my friends in college had a very strict rule that he did not read books where the characters have punctuation in their names, in the middle of their names,
Klingons. And
that rules out Superman.
That rules off every Irish
Superman
author in the history. Right. Also,
that's true.
Also, Flannery O'Connor for you.
No, Cal-El.
No,
Cal-El. Yeah. No, not his original name. I don't care about that. Superman is fine.
I had a rule that I was not going to read any book when I was a kid unless there was a map on the front case. Because I thought if the author isn't going to take the time...
Wow, you and I were reverses of
each
other.
We absolutely were. The author isn't going to take the time to tell me where the magic castle is situated versus the mystical forest. I mean,
and
I was going
to
bother.
That needs to be
you
crossed,
have to put in the time. That's what that was my thing. Yeah. I mean, I wanted topology is what I wanted.
What see, for me, I wouldn't read any book that didn't contain the words Encyclopedia Brown and the...
That's I can't really defend it from a sort of the scope of this writer, the imagination, the fact that he's worked out all the languages. Some people,
you're actually unconvincing.
Yeah, you're digging the hole deeper there.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, I'm perfectly. The writing is sort of hoary and tweety and sort of old world. And, you know, if you don't like Yonder Lies the Castle of My Father, these ain't the books for you, because this is what this guy does. The fact that the enemies tend to be darker skinned and swarthy. I mean, like none of this works.
So you're trying to sell me on the racism.
I'm saying I totally get
come
that
for
it's
the topography, stay for the racism.
So I'm supposed to I'm come saying, for the map and distinct language.
I'm saying
and stay
this
for
thing
the racism.
No, I'm saying this
stay
thing
for the stay for the talking walking trees who are you know elemental
oh,
and old.
Sure.
You know?
And yeah, this thing gets its hooks into you young or it doesn't. I would venture to say.
So
and
if I've lived this long.
I'm going to give you a buy. You get a buy.
I'm going to say no. I never read them when I was a kid. I read The Hobbit when I was a kid, but I never read Lord of the Rings when I was little. Mm-hmm. And I picked it up probably about 8-10 years ago and went through it at a clip.
Right. Hobbit is a great kid's book. I mean, it's a solid read. It doesn't have all this sort of off-putting stuff that The Lord of the Rings has. All this back history and, you know, appendices A through ZZ. It doesn't have any of that stuff. It's just a simple kid story that's really, I think, just...
Yeah, it's got the texture but not the depth.
All right,
yeah.
Look, I will come clean. I will explain.
Uh-huh. Cut to a crib.
That's right.
My mother worked with elves.
No,
not really.
She was in theater? What?
No, she didn't really.
Okay.
I was just trying to, you know, make
bring
you
it back.
I want to support you.
If you're not going to dig it with the movies, you're not going to dig it. I mean, the movies kind of take it and, I think they did a really good job.
So I have to start with the movies and the
No.
Sean
I say start with a book. Start with The Hobbit and see how far you get.
All right. Well, if you are interested in convincing any of us to engage our pop culture blind spots, and the whole idea is that we are notionally open.
Right. More than notionally.
If you would like to lecture us mercilessly.
Come to Monkey See, the NPR pop culture and entertainment blog. Also, you can yell at us on Twitter. I am found at NPR Monkey See. Stephen, where are you found?
I am found at I Dislike Stephen, spelled STEPHEN.
A sentiment we can all get behind. How about you, Trey Graham?
I am at Trey Graham, TREY. That's Trey with an E, and Graham like the cracker.
Oh.
All right, Glenn, how about you?
I am G.H. Weldon, spelled like it sounds.
Now, the music that you are hearing over our Twitter handles is by someone in this room.
That's exactly right. It is also provided by...
our fearless producer.
Our esteemed and fearless producer, Mike Katziff, who makes us all sound far smarter by taking out all the parts where we don't have any idea what we're doing.
And has put up with an awful lot of that today.
Thank you, Mike Katziff.
Thanks,
Mike. Who can be found at...
Mike Katziff.
That's K-A-T-Z-I-F. That brings us to the end of Pop Culture Happy Hour. Thanks, everybody, and we will see you again next time.